John, at the very end of your expert response, you said it is never a bad idea to train beyond the ACS. I have a funny feeling in that Mooney on that day when you had to make the taxi of shame back with the broken gear door, you probably were doubting that very statement. How do you balance that? How do you decide that something risky is worth the training value and that the risk of the training isn't worse, basically, than what you're trying to cure?
Well, I think the key is that, I mean, pretty much everything, I don't want to say everything that we do in aviation, but aviation has risks. And if we wanted to be 100% risk-free, we would never take the airplane out of the hangar. The key is more about proficiency, training, and understanding the risks. And as I said in my response, I think the issue there was that I had gotten complacent. You do something repeatedly. How many times do we take off over a congested area, over a city, over a downtown airport? And every time we do that, there's a certain element of risk involved. And that's just part of flying. You try to mitigate the risk by training. And in this case, it was more the complacency, I think, that got me than the actual risk. So I still stand by my statement that it's never a bad idea to go beyond the ACS as long as you can do it with skill and proficiency in that specific training.
Did you brief that student that there was going to be a low engine cut? So there was no briefing at all. This was a complete surprise.
Nope. It was a complete surprise. And that was a lot of the soul searching too, is that we had never practiced it. We had never discussed it. I had done an engine outs from pattern altitude, but never from 150 or 200 feet with that particular client.
Dave.
Yeah, John, I got to say, you talk about soul searching on this one, and it seems to me that you've got a lot more soul searching to do, because this is a, this strikes me as an absolutely terrible thing to practice. On the risk reward scale, it is so badly skewed toward the risk side. When I hear you describing this, it just seems like, you know, you're doing this for realism. You want to have this life-saving realism. And, you know, this strikes me as realism. It's unrealistic training that's masquerading as realism. You know, the potentially life-saving part of this is the part that we don't emphasize. It's the 5 seconds of startle factor and inaction. And it seems to me that it's like, okay, you have a low altitude engine failure in a single engine airplane. Do we want to practice a skill of landing softly? You know, I mean, it's like, or timing the flare. I don't think so. I mean, it strikes me as if you have a low altitude engine failure, the training benefit is to reduce the time of the startle factor, to reduce that 5 seconds. And practicing the flare and timing the flare for a high risk, unlikely to ever happen situation just seems loony. And you know, it's unrealistic, because how often are you going to be using a 9,000 foot runway for a takeoff in a 182? That seldom happens in my experience. It just seems like the risk reward is completely out of whack. And if my new partner wanted to practice this to a full stop landing, I would want to find a new partner, because that just seems like terrible headwork.
Paul, then Michael.
I couldn't disagree more with Dave. You probably know, I think you do, Jeff, that I went through this with one of our Mooney partners. We lost the airplane in this exact scenario. The engine quit at about 250 feet. You had no choice but to land ahead. Wound up in a salt marsh, and they survived it. The airplane was totaled. But the way we trained it at the time, he was relatively new to retractable, so we did a hell of a lot after engine takeoff scenarios. And what you're training for here is not the touchdown. You're training for the ability to cope with that ground rush, because when that engine quits, you got to get the nose down right now. Bits and pieces of stuff on the floor need to be floating up, and you need to get light in the seat in order to prevent a stall or stall spin. So the way I trained it is, and I still do this today, is we had it actually on the checklist, is I tighten my sphincter to 100 foot-pounds and tell myself, the engine's going to really quit on this takeoff. I'm going to be ready for it. Taxi out on the runway, take off, get to speed, and when I get to pattern altitude and it doesn't quit, hey, I'm ahead of the game, lucked out again. And that's the way I trained it. And far from being rare, this scenario is common. It is a killer. After takeoff engine failures, stall spin are very common. And that's why I trained with our partner. We must have done, I'm sure we did 20 or 30 of them. A few two landings, but most of them were go rounds, because what I wanted him to see was that sight picture of the ground coming up, and to be not so much comfortable with it, but be able to cope with it and not completely panic to get the airplane down in some kind of survivable crash.
So, Paul, would you do this in your choices there only to the go around, or you would do the landing as well with the instructor? So, you know, he knows how to do it. Where would you fall on that line then?
You know, we did a couple of landings, but it's scary and it's dangerous. And there I agree with Dave. I'm not sure that's worth the training value. So most of them were to go arounds. But that doesn't matter, because if you've trained in that stimulus response to get the nose over and be comfortable with that ground rush, you've won. Because more than likely the airplane will touch down in some kind of survivable impact. And that's exactly what happened with our gear up, gear down, doesn't matter.
Michael.
Yeah, I guess so. I partially agree with both of, with Dave and Paul. I look at option two because I think the risk reward of damaging the airplane is just way too high if you bring it to a landing. And I think we're trying to really train for an emergency. An engine failure, low altitude, single engine airplane after takeoff is an emergency. And as Paul points out, getting the nose over to maintain speed so they don't have a stall spin accident near the ground, to me, is the most important thing. And then the second thing is understanding that when that happens, it's an emergency and the airplane doesn't matter at that point, right? So I think if I was going to do this with a student, I would do it to a go around because we're really trying to save their life, not the airplane. I don't care about the airplane at that point. So you have a low altitude engine failure. And as Paul points out, how many times you do that on a 9,000 foot runway? Probably not many. So the idea of realizing the engine failure, reducing the startle factor, pushing the nose over quickly, and then arresting the sink at the bottom is the most important part, even if it's in a marsh, trees, grass, or whatever. So I would practice it to a go around just because I think the landing is almost irrelevant at that time. If they have a little bit higher sink rate and they hurt the airplane, that's just part of, then consider themselves lucky, right?
Let me give John a moment to defend himself here, because I'm kind of in the boat with John and then Richard after that. John.
So to make it perfectly clear, I agree with Paul and Dave both that in training, there's a high risk with this. And that's why, you know, in the real world, you don't get a second chance. It's you got to do that right. And the only way you can do that is by experiencing that rush that's coming up and how quickly this happens. I think the realism part of it is finding the altitude that it's going to take to be able to push over, regain flying speed, and land on the remaining runway. And that's why it's going to take 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 feet of runway. And there's not many times that we fly our GA airplanes off that kind of runway. So the other part of the training, of the takeaway on this, is if you're on a 3,000 foot runway, there's no way all you're going to do is as Michael said, just push it over and get into the weeds under control. You're not going to be able to land back on the runway again. And that's why I talked about retracting the gear. There's no point in trying to land again on the remaining runway because it's just not going to happen. If you try that, you're going to run out of energy very quickly. So I think that it's an important demonstration. And the key is that it takes a lot of altitude and a lot of runway to be able to do this and to be able to do it safely to get back to landing. And if you don't have that, that's part of your pre-takeoff briefing and should go into your planning.
Richard, then Dean, then Michael.
So, you know, for me, the proof was in, have I ever actually done this as an instructor? And the answer is no. My initial reaction to the scenario was no, I wouldn't do it. The risk isn't worth what the training you're going to get. And part of that answer goes to, well, if you're going to train something like this and you want students to be proficient at it, it's like flying multi-engine. You can't just do it once. You have to do it repeatedly. Or maybe the objective here was, and John, maybe that's where you were headed, was you would do it once with a student to demonstrate what that's really going to look and feel like. And as a demonstration, I kind of see the value of it there. So if I were to do it, it would only be a go around, and I would do it at a pretty high altitude, 700 feet at least, to give them the startle factor, and then it would be a go around. But I'm still not sure I would do it. I'm still not sure the risk is worth it.
That's the point, though, that I was trying to make, is the demonstration of that. And there's no way to simulate that without that ground rush coming up and doing it. And to do it at 700 feet might take a 10,000 foot runway. 700 feet, you can do it. That's like a 1 mile final. You know, you should have enough energy at that point to be able to land. The 200 feet is really the hard part, because of how much energy you lose from the pitch up configuration to the pitch down, and then still have enough airspeed to flare. That's the most dangerous part of it. And that would reinforce, you're probably not going to be able to do it successfully from that altitude. It's going to have to be higher. And that would be the takeaway, to show the student what it takes to be able to do that.
Dean.
Sure. Yes, I'm thinking that there might be a third possibility in this scenario that we haven't talked about yet, and that's a partial engine failure. And I went out one morning with a friend years ago in a Ronca Champ, and we took off, and almost immediately, I don't know how high we were, maybe 50 feet, and had a partial engine failure because a spark plug flew out of one of the cylinders. Somebody had just screwed it in by hand and clipped a little clip on it. So I landed on the runway, and it worked out great. Our runway is 6,000 feet long. However, hearing you guys process all this makes me think that maybe I have been erroneously thinking that landing on the runway is easy. And I'm listening to this, and it's a big eye-opener for me, because in my case, I had plenty of power in the Champ to land straight ahead, whereas I'm realizing now that if you have a complete engine failure, that's a whole different story.
And so much depends upon the kind of airplane, the Champ, you know, versus a heavy, a Bonanza or something like that, that's going to run out of energy quickly. There's a big, big difference there too.
Mike?
Yeah. Again, I think the airplane is important. The Champ is so light and the runway was long, and you did have some thrust available just to help you. But when you think of a Mooney or a Bonanza or something like that, the wing loading is high. And we talk about energy a lot. And what does energy mean, right? I think, Richard, probably you and I and Dave as well, if you're an aerobatic guy, I think of energy as G available, right? So how hard can I pull on the stick before the airplane stalls and comes out from underneath me? And Paul talks about stall spins. And I think one of the things I would like to do with a student at altitude, pick a hard deck, 5,000 feet, 3,000 feet, whatever, do this simulated engine failure and a pushover, but just how hard can they pull back on the stick, at what speed, and arrest the sink rate? That's the most important thing. And I think to do that obviously near the ground is too high, but what are we really trying to do is prevent a stall spin accident at the bottom, but giving the student the understanding of how much elevator movement, stick travel, energy, G available, however you want to term it, is left at the bottom to save their life if the inevitable occurs.
Well, Michael, that kind of argues to actually doing this to a landing and not just to a go around, because if part of what you're trying to do is give a sense of pushing forward, conserving your energy, you know, what little energy you have left in the bank, so that you can withdraw it at the last minute in the flare and not land so hard that people have back injuries, you know, maybe that, even if in the real world you'd land off a runway, to go through the experience of like, wow, we were coming down really fast and that's how much energy I still had left, maybe even drop the flaps at the very end, all that technique, granted, right, to save the occupants, not save the airplane, but to prevent a super hard slap versus a survivable hit. Back to you, Michael.
Well, we practice stalls in such a benign way, right? Power to idle, pretend we're slow, we're coming down the glide path, we flare to land, we stall the airplane under 1G, and then how often does it happen like that? Probably never, right? So my thought is people, they don't understand that the stick position relates directly to an angle of attack. The further the aft the stick comes, the closer you are to an AO, to the stalling angle. And today we have all of these electronic devices that tell us that. And when we teach unusual attitude training and performance flying here, the one thing that we cement is the airplane will always stall at the same point of stick travel, unless you're obviously you're in a fly-by-wire airplane. But the further aft the stick comes, the higher the AOA is going to be, and it's going to stall. And making that connection in their brain is the most important thing. And it also gets rid of speed, right? Speed doesn't becomes unnecessary. So the airspeed indicator doesn't matter. How far back the stick is and how hard you're pulling on it and how fast you're going, it gives you that ability to arrest the sink rate.
Dave, and then Richard.
Yeah, it just seems like the point of practicing these potentially catastrophic emergencies is to come away with a survivable result. And, you know, there's a real logical inconsistency here because, you know, in John's describing this scenario, I totally agree with his decision to raise the gear, you know, probably earlier than most people would do it. And if an engine failure were to happen then, you know, you're going to have the insurance company owns the airplane, as John said, and you're going to walk away from the result. It's the same with practicing these engine out, low altitude emergencies. Reduce the startle factor, push it over. Don't care about the landing so much because it's going to be a survivable landing. And that's the goal of the training. The whole practicing the touchdown part, to me, just seems like a bad risk reward deal.
Richard, and then back to me.
Yeah, just one thing to consider, Jeff. We talked about how often this happens and the frequency of it happens. I disagree a little bit with Paul's observation that this happens all the time. The latest NAAL report that the ASI put out, there were a total of 81 accidents that were attributed to power plant failure, 8 of those of which were fatal. How many of those were on takeoff? I don't know. I'd have to dig a little bit deeper. So the point is, it doesn't happen all the time to the point that it's a fatal incident. So it goes back to training for what's the most likely scenarios and the problematic scenarios. And in my mind, it goes back to the risk involved in this particular maneuver doesn't track with what we're seeing with how pilots are having trouble in the real world.
You know, it makes me wonder, especially since we've got instructors around the table here, it sounds like the general consensus is that the pushover and the ground rush effect and recovering what energy you can, that's the most important part of training like this. But is it something that the instructor should do? Remember, in this scenario, this person wants to add this to their instructional, you know, sort of bag of tricks. Is it important for the instructor to actually go all the way through the landing for the scenario of, as John said, even salvaging a point where it's like a go around is impossible or even risky, and the thing to do is to just land straight ahead? So not necessarily doing it with all your students, but in this case, do I sway anyone to actually practice it because the instructor needs to have a little more information and go further? Can I convince anyone on the camp, Paul, to come further?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I think we all pretty much agree that the landing is immaterial. That's not what we're training for here. So we're training to understand energy management and the need to get the nose down and unload the wing in the event of an engine failure after takeoff. And so if an instructor has seen that and done that, that's probably 90% of it. But I also disagree that you can't train this to the landing if you want to do that. You can't train it relatively safely. I don't necessarily see a big training value to it, but I've done it. And, you know, if you've got a couple hundred feet, you've got enough time to recover some energy and land engine out and you see what it's like. You don't necessarily need to make a habit of it or train that with students, but you see what it looks like. And I think there's some aircraft handling value to that. So, I agree with you, Jeff.
So this is a little bit of a change of topic here. And it's been a nice long round table here, but there's one more question just because we've got Dean at the table here that I do want to ask. How often do we have an AMPIA here? All of us have had landings with students, especially power off landings, that we wondered if we still had a flyable airplane anymore. And certainly the people, if they actually do this scenario, and it's a 182, there's probably not a 182 out there without, bulkhead damage on it from somebody's hard landing somewhere. You know, Dean, if these guys did this and they land hard, like really hard, what do they look for when they taxi back to the ramp to make sure that they still, presuming they didn't blow out a tire or something like that, just because I think people would be interested, like how hard is a hard landing? Do we really, these planes are pretty robust. Obviously John bent a gear door, but you know, are there a couple like telltales or things that like, if you're worried, taxi back and check this and this, or is it too more complex than that?
Yeah, I agree with you. These airplanes are amazingly robust, and it totally amazes me how I watch the hard landings that happen, and I've been in some hard landings and how they stand up to all this. But immediately when you park the airplane, you can go around and look at all the landing gear attachment points and be looking for any wrinkling in the skin around those areas, around the main gear areas. If you're really concerned, you can have somebody open it up and look inside at the structure in there. And then on the Cessna 182, you might want to remove the cowling and look at the whole firewall area and the nose gear attachment area. And as you were talking, Jeff, we have a Cessna 182 in one of the shops at our local airport right now that has a whole bunch of the lower belly skin removed. And it's having a huge major repair because this exact thing happened. It had to happen. I don't know when it happened, but somebody obviously slammed the nose gear down really hard. And I think it flew after that. And then at some point later, somebody discovered that you could actually, if you would grab the prop and kind of bob it up and down, there was this unusual flexing that was happening. And they discovered that there was major structure damage down in that area. So yes, by all means, have it checked out if there's any question.
You know, I think the real takeaway from this scenario is just this concept of risk and reward. And, you know, we've all talked about it around this table. Paul's written about it. Dave's mentioned it many times as well. How do you balance that risk of something unlikely but potentially catastrophic? You know, a stall spin at low altitude is fatal if it happens, even if it doesn't happen maybe that often, versus having some kind of hedge against that, but that carries its own risk. And granted, aviation is risky all around, but listening to everyone here, it seems like the real point is to kind of dissect what are you really trying to prevent? And what is the least risky way that you can make that happen? And here, it seems like the big thing is that if something goes wrong in those first several hundred feet, you must be preloaded, hair trigger to push. Keep what energy you have. And after that, gear up or gear down, good flare or bad flare, remaining runway or not remaining runway, you don't have a choice. You're landing, but get as much energy as you can. Keep as much energy as you can for that flare to save the people and just let the airplane go.